What's happening, everybody? You're now tuning in to the Producer's Corner with Spud Too Tight, and I have a very special show for you today. On the phone with me, I have a returning guest. He is a very gifted and prolific musician. He is a musical genius and an innovator when it comes to composing, producing, and performing on the keyboards, and has created a legacy of over 30 years in the business. Please put your hands together and welcome keyboardist, producer, and musician, Mr. Jeff Lorber. How's it going, Jeff?
Very well, thank you. Thanks for having me on the show.
Oh, man, glad to have you back, man. You know, the last time we chopped it up, man, you were working on your other CD, Now Is The Time, which was really hot, man. You had a couple of classics and remakes on there and some new material. And now you're back with your new release, Galaxy.
It's basically just kind of a continuation of the Now Is The Time record. I mean, there are some significant differences, but... you know, the direction of that record was something that that I really liked, and it seemed like it was well received by the critics and the audience. So we just decided this is, in a way, it's sort of like part two of Now Is The Time.
Wow, you know, a couple of tracks on the album, man, really stuck with me. The whole CD is just fire to begin with, Jeff. But a couple of the tracks that really stood out, and I really feel that gave it your sonic flavor. Was Live Wire, Big Brother, and Monster Rap, man, which I really love, in particular because of the wah-wah and the flanger that you held over the Fender Rhodes, man. You know, it just really gives it that edge and gives it that grunt. You know, I'm a huge funk fan, like I mentioned before, and, you know, a lot of times I just hear a lot of guys playing the Fender Rhodes straight, but, you know, on occasion I'll hear a nice wah-wah flanger effect on it, man. It just really gives it that edge.
Yeah, that's a cool sound. That's, I believe it or not, that's actually a stock. You know, I normally use a real Rhodes all the time.
Sure.
But that particular sound, it's a real cool sound. It's a stock sound that's in most of Yamaha's Motif and S90 keyboards, and it's called Early Fusion is the name of it.
Oh yeah.
and it's a cool sound. I've just, you know, it's just, you know, every once in a while you find these sounds. You know, I've had to make do with you know, when I play live with Yamaha keyboards quite a bit, because, you know, I love playing acoustic piano. I always try to play that, but you know, the Yamaha keyboards, they basically give you, you know, good, solid, meat and potatoes keyboard sounds that you can use in a live situation when it's sort of impossible to try to, you know, carry a real Fender Rhodes and all that kind of equipment around. And, yeah, you know, so once in a while you find these patches that are in there that, or occasionally you can kind of create your own, too, that that really work for you. And that's one of them. And it's funny because... there's something about that particular patch, the way it it blends with the saxophone. It's really, really cool. It's just has an interesting interaction with those frequencies.
Oh yeah, I definitely agree, man. You know, that's, you're really getting heavy into the advanced side of patching and recording, Joe. But, you know, one of the things I want to bring up and piggyback off what you said is, you know, finding the right patches that sit well in the mix on top of other musicians. You know, sometimes we can get something that's really aggressive, and, you know, just the way it's created and channeled with the frequencies, it can really be overbearing on the other instruments in the mix. And yeah, I definitely got to take my hats off to Yamaha and their Fender Rhodes patches.
Actually, you know what it reminds me of a little bit, the way that works on that song, is when you think of the sound that War got when they had alto sax and harmonica together. It's just such a cool, great sound, and so unique. You know, like their song "Low Rider" and a whole lot of their other hits that they had. It's just, you know, that's kind of what that sound reminds me of, when the alto sax plus this early fusion Yamaha patch.
Sure. Oh yeah, definitely. You know, me in particular, man, I've been a huge fan of Scarby's library for their Fender Rhodes. You know, I have the Motif rack, and Early Fusion was probably the one I've gravitated to out of the Motif library. But I've been really happy with the samples out of the Scarby Fender Rhodes library. It's really nice, man.
Yeah, I've heard that people like that. You know, for me, I for the most part, I kind of stay away from soft synths. The only one that I really use is I use like Omnisphere and, so, you know, some of the Spectrasonic stuff. I mean, I want to get into more of it because I know there's great stuff there. I guess I'm kind of a snob that I like I like playing real keyboards, you know. I just really like the real thing. And I think, to some extent, I know that there's great software out there, but to some extent, I think the real thing has a dimension and a depth. And also, you know, I really dig the fact that, well, you know, that this isn't the case at all with that Yamaha thing, but for most of the record, it's real Rhodes and real piano or real Rhodes or... And you know, every time you play a note, it's a little different. You know, the profile of the frequency spectrum totally changes depending on how hard you hit it, yeah. And how it you know hits the electronics of those instruments. Well, you know, when you talk about a Rhodes or a Wurlitzer. And so I like that. I like the unpredictability, and I like the range of expression that you get. You know, in fact, you know, there's this weird thing that's happened, which is some of the newer keyboards and even some of the patches in the newer Yamahas, they sort of like take out some of the dirt that you really want. For example, like if you go to a piano or a Fender Rhodes and you take the palm of your hand and you just play like seven notes real hard, it's going to sound ugly.
Yeah.
You know, you know, it'll sound distorted and it'll sound kind of messed up. But that's sort of expression. You know, the instrument does that. And some of these new instruments, they want everything to sound so clean and so pretty. You do that on some of these samplers, and it doesn't sound ugly. It sounds pretty. You know?
Exactly. No, I totally agree.
They don't let you get that kind of an expression out of it. They take that away from you, which you know, which I don't like, I guess.
No, I you wouldn't see it if you're not a keyboardist. You know what I mean? I think a lot of guys, if you're really not playing the full chords and a lot of progressions and really being active on the board, you're not going to hear the difference. You know what I mean? But as players, man, there are certain expressions and, you know, certain colors that I look for with tracking, because it just makes you get into the groove a little bit more if you feel like you got the meat and potatoes behind your phrasings, you know. So yeah, I totally agree with you, Jeff, man.
I mean, you know, I might have mentioned this last time, I don't know if I did, but you know, my theory about, like, I've gone so full circle with my feelings about recording, because when I first moved to LA, I was hanging out with all these people that were such snobs about everything had to be API and everything had to be named. And I just thought, oh, you don't need all that. Screw that, man. All you need is a good song. It doesn't matter how you record it. And I've sort of learned that those guys were actually right. And, you know, the people that were kind of purists about sound in the studio and using good equipment, I mean, that really makes a huge difference. And so I found that just using really good instruments, using really good, you know, like 96K recording, and getting good signals out of good instruments and good arrangements. I mean, you're like 90% of the way there to a great sounding arrangement, just with having great sounds to begin with, and being real careful about how you arrange things too, of course, and make a great song and a great you know, the way the bass line and the drums and everything fit together. I mean, obviously that's key.
Right. You know, but, you know, Jeff, I listened to a lot of your music over the years, man. And to me, listening to it sonically, you've always had a well-balanced mix throughout your CDs, even your earlier releases. Are you a hands-on type of producer, engineer, where you like to sit in and mix on your own? Or do you have another engineer on the side of you to assist and, you know, really drive the console?
Well, I've only just recently, I mean, I've always been very, very interested in engineering. There was like an early point of when I had, in the early 80s, I had like a little 8-track rig, and I was working with the guy that was sort of the mixer from my band, and I wasn't that involved in engineering, and this gentleman accidentally erased a song I had been working on for a week, and so I fired him immediately. And then all of a sudden, wow. I had to learn how to use this stuff.
Right.
So that's how I learned how to record, was just, and I'm sure you've heard this from other people, that if you learn the basics of recording from a very, very primitive little rig, like just a Tascam, TAC, and a Sun mixer or something like that,
yeah,
that's basically the same stuff. When you get to an SSL and you get to the top of the line professional gear, you're dealing with the same stuff. You're dealing with equalizers, levels.
Oh yeah.
You know, compression, you know, it doesn't really matter what kind of equipment you're using. If you learn the basics, you can just transfer your knowledge from something that's really cheap and primitive into something that's really great. And that's what shocked me, is like how easy it was when I started working on Neve and SSL boards. how easy it was to understand it and to make that transition.
No, totally, man. You know, being a keyboardist, and you'll probably agree, Jeff, that, you know, as a keyboardist, because we're working in a multi-timbral world, you know what I mean? And, you know, we're already getting the early stages of balancing volumes on different tracks, you know what I mean? So believe it or not, I mean, a lot of the keyboardists may not know, it's like, man, you're already getting your first lessons in mixing because, you know, to be able to balance out your patches so they sit right in the mix and balance out your drum machine. So you're really getting a feel of maybe using a virtual console, whether it's on your keyboard or the computer, but man,
well, I was an early adopter to the use of drum machines and, you know, doing my own arranging at home with, I had a DMX, DSX system and like the Lindrum. And so, yeah, I started out really early with kind of doing my own arrangements at home. Once again, in the late 70s, early 80s. And, I'm still doing it. I mean, even though most of the records that I make have all these live instruments and it sounds like a live band in the studio, everything starts with the writing, the writing process all starts with basically me kind of doing it all myself. And I'll tell you another like little secret that I have that I think is key, which is I have like a lot of, songs that I've worked on that have live drums, and I have sort of a list of the tempos of the songs. So a lot of times, if I'm working on something, I will actually borrow a drum track from another song just temporarily to kind of get the thing going. So I usually always, not quite always, but very often, like more often than not, I'll start with some kind of drum track that's a live drummer.
Nice.
From another song, and you know, then eventually I'll replace it. But I think just working with live drums, to me, it just breathes so much life into the music. And there's nothing like it. You know, occasionally you want to have, R&B ballads sound real cool with drum machines sometimes.
Yeah.
And, you know, occasionally you come up with rhythmic ideas that a typical drum part won't, you know, cut it. But That's definitely one of my secrets that like immediately gets me off, like, you know, off the landing strip into the air immediately. You know, when I get that that live drum track on my song that I'm working on, it just automatically just makes it feel so much better.
It does. You know, as keyboardists, man, I tell everybody, I said, dude, if you're not in the pocket with your track and you're not really feeling the rhythm of the song, man, it's really just not going to, it'll take you out of your zone. You know what I mean? Between the bass and the drums, I really got to have those guys in sync for me to really start to groove, you know?
that's absolutely true. And, you know, you were talking about being a keyboard player. It gives you some insight into, the recording process. You know, the thing is, I always thought that guitar players were the guys that, because they create their sound so much with effects,
sure,
that they have they have kind of a leg up when it comes to engineering, because immediately they just have a very deep knowledge of what compression does, what delay does, what distortion does, and they have all that experience with working on guitars. And once again, you can take that knowledge and you can just transfer that over to sitting in front of a computer or a mixing desk and start to use some of those effects on a mix.
Oh yeah, totally. You know, and they're in the analog world too. You know, where you and I, man, we're pretty much in the audio world and digital world with our keyboards. And you know, unless you're running a lot of live instruments from your Fender Rhodes and maybe a live piano too. You know, there's a lot of miking techniques that can be applied there. But yeah, guitar players, drummers, man, they usually get their hands on the analog side of mixing. Versus the MIDI side. So, yeah, man. But again, it all comes to a full circle at the end. So, yeah, I totally agree with you, Joe.
It's interesting, like, when you read, like, these magazines, like SOS and especially Tape Op and some of these different audiophile magazines, there's just an unbelievable fondness for analog and retro gear.
Oh yeah.
I love it too. I have to admit. I think I love. You know, I guess it's just because it's my background. That's where I came from.
Yeah.
But it's almost like too much, I guess. <'Cause> it's like, even though we're all, you know, we all have to work in Pro Tools. We're working in the digital world, but it seems like there's an enormous, just you know, people like those tools or the digital recreations of those tools more than anything.
Yeah, totally.
There's a bias, I guess. That's what I was going to say.
Oh, there is totally. There is a total bias. You know, I come from an analog world, too. I started tracking an analog around 88, 89. I was only 14, 15 at the time, but I had a 8-track, Tascam Studio B 8-track mixer, had the built-in reel-to-reel, and, you know, I really got my chance to understand my ins and outs and my channels and arming and, you know, just to understand the whole mixing process and the recording process. Mm-hmm. But, you know, I think having that analog background was really nice coming into the DAW world of recording, because again, I kind of just knew my way in routing and how things should be routed. And, you know, having that analog background has just been a key essential tool and an asset to have in my career musically. So with all the musicians that you worked in, Jeff, were there anybody new that made appearance or featured on this new CD?
Well, on the last record, we used a guy, Larry Koontz, on I think on the song Chinese Medicinal Herbs. We were so thrilled with his playing that on this record we had him play on 3 songs, and he's just phenomenal. He's such a great soloist.
Wow!
And I just loved, you know, bringing him in. You know, basically it's the same crew. It's Eric, Jimmy, Vinny. I mean, there's no drummer. There's hardly any drummer better than Vinny. He's, you know, once you put those drums on with Vinny, that's like the gold standard, you know? And I just love working with musicians that you don't have to tell them anything, because they always come up with something that's generally way better than what you even would ask them to do if you were going to tell them to do something. But that's what's great about working with people of this caliber. They just constantly surprise you and amaze you with their talent and what they come up with. Michael Thompson just came up with just some insane guitar parts. There's all these sort of pulsating guitar parts. They sound like keyboards on the song Live Wire you were talking about.
Yeah.
Which is one of my favorites. And, yeah, he just did some phenomenal work on that. The same way he came up with some crazy sounds on the last record on our version of Mysterious Traveler. I'm trying to think if we had anybody new on this one. We probably did, but it's not coming to mind immediately. But yeah, right. It's pretty much the same crew. But I'll tell you, man, this is like the main reason why I love living in Los Angeles, is to be around musicians like this. Just every one of them just was so generous with their creativity and just brought so much to it. And yeah, it was just fun and it was easy. You just call these guys up and bam. Well, I'll tell you one guy that was a new development on this record was we had Michael Brower mixed 6 of the 11 tracks.
Nice.
And that was really just a an accident that happened. I've been a huge fan of his since the 80s. You know, I never met him.
Right.
But I just, you know, every time I pick up album credits and I'd see his name listed as mixer, I would notice that the records just sounded amazing.
Wow.
Especially this group Change, that I really loved the stuff that he did with them. And then I just noticed that he was still working and he just got some Grammy Awards. So I sort of just reached out to him and sort of sent a little fan letter to his website.
Yeah.
And we kind of became friends, and turned out he had like an extra day open around the time I was mixing, and I flew to New York and we spent one day and mixed 6 songs. So it was great. It was great to meet him and work with him. It was one of those things that was like even better than I could have hoped that it would be. You know, I sort of figured we'd mix, you know, maybe 3 or 4 songs. We ended up doing 6. We started at 10 in the morning. We finished at 2 a.m.
Wow.
So he was really, really generous too. And it was just a, you know, just amazing experience to work in his studio with all the unbelievable gear that he's got. And I don't know if you've ever seen a picture of his rig, but I think it beats almost anything else out there. The only other guy that I know that's got a rig like that is Jack Joseph Puig. He's got a lot of equipment too, but I don't think Michael Brower is far behind.
No, I mean, there's a lot of guys with a lot of nice tools and rigs out there. Last time I spoke to you, Jeff, man, you were tracking in Pro Tools and recording. Are you still in Pro Tools now?
Oh yeah. I'm sort of really mulling this whole thing over about Pro Tools 10 and the new hardware and stuff. You know, there's a lot of controversy about it, and there's it seems like there's a lot of excitement about it, actually. You know, right. I think there's some, you know, I think some people aren't happy with how much money it's going to cost them. You know, nobody ever wants to do that, but but it seems like there's some real excitement about the speed and some of the new features that really kind of streamline the whole operation of the program, it seems like.
Sure. Well, last time I talked to you, man, I was primarily a Logic Pro user. I've been a Logic Pro user for years, but I had the pleasure and opportunity to speak to Mr. Teddy Riley, who introduced me to Studio One Pro. And I tell you what, Jeff, I was one of those guys, man, that was really holding on to Logic, man, because I was just a diehard disciple of Logic. But, man, Studio One is probably the best tracking DAW that I've ever used, as far as the keyboards.
And that's what Teddy's using?
Yes, Studio One Pro. You got to check it out, man.
Okay.
As far as the quantize, just the overall workflow, having access to your library, your sounds, your loops, it's just organized really easy.
I sort of knew Teddy a little bit back in the days in the early 80s when we were both working together very often at Larrabee Studio in West Hollywood.
Yeah.
And he was very gracious. I remember one time like seeing him in the hallway or something when we started hanging out, and he actually gave me, I probably have it around here somewhere, he gave me, we were both using MPC 60 for arranging.
Sure.
And he gave me a disc of the, you know, some of the drum sounds he was using, which at the time were all, they were all like different, like little edits of James Brown records.
Oh, yeah. Uh-huh.
Every drum that he used was like, was something from a James Brown record, and the way they were, the way the sounds were edited wasn't very slick either. It was sort of like dirty and raw, and it kept, you know, it really retained the energy and the attitude of those James Brown records, actually, which I think is probably, but yeah, he's brilliant, and you know, I those Black Street records, those are some of my favorite records, and so he knows what he's doing. I'm a fan of his.
Oh yeah, man, Teddy Riley's been my, I like to call him my Obi-Wan Kenobi for production, keyboardist, and recording engineering. It is bringing out the next best thing to music, man. I just really followed his career, and, you know, just to have that one-on-one time with him to introduce me to something like Studio One as a keyboardist was just really beneficial to me. And
hey, you know, I think, you know, it's funny because both of us, I think, built studios that were, to some extent, modeled after Larrabee. I think we both liked Larrabee so much. Like, my studio is almost in a perfect recreation of Studio B at Larrabee, the old Larrabee that doesn't exist anymore,
right,
by the way, in West Hollywood. And I know that a bunch of the Larrabee guys went out to Virginia to build Teddy's studio that probably had a lot of the same characteristics. I was wondering if he still had that studio and if he was working there, if you knew that.
He's not working at Future Recordings anymore. He's kind of all over the place, man. L.A., Korea, Atlanta. Teddy's all over, man. But I know he's no longer recording or tracking in Virginia Beach, Virginia at Future Recording Studio. Yeah, that, he's moved on and evolved to something bigger, man. He's always on something new, so. But that's cool, man. You guys had that relationship, man. I can imagine the work that you guys could have really put together on a project. So.
Well, that's when he was working with his manager at the time, Gene Griffin.
Oh, yeah.
So that's going way back.
Oh, yeah. You know, when you're working with another artist or musician for the first time, Jeff, what are some of the things that you do to establish that rapport in the studio?
Well, that's an interesting question because, you know, it's tricky because, well, if you're working with somebody that's an established artist and that's somebody that's very, you know, that has a full form musical personality and musical point of view, like, you know, I've worked with guys like Dave Koz, Michael Franks, Herb Alpert, Richard Elliott, Rick Braun, you know, people like that, you know, there's basically, it's great when you're working with those guys, because basically you just kind of come in, you're kind of like equals, you have something to give them, they have a very focused and specific approach to music that you know, is well, you know, established, and, yeah. And so basically, you know, you're kind of coming in, you're like a doctor or something, and you look at this artist and you say, like, what can I do to maximize, you know, this person's musical expression? What can I do to make a great, great song and a great production for these people? Wow. So that's sort of the ideal situation when you're working with people that are new to the scene and that are less focused and less they haven't really established their personality. Then it becomes more difficult,
right?
Because then you got to be careful. You know, you don't want to like step in and kind of create your musical personality and stick that in there in place of theirs,
right?
You know, so you just have to be careful with that, you know, to sort of nurture it and just see what you have and see what's there that's good. And, you know, basically it just takes sensitivity and, it's like any other kind of human communication, I guess. You know, you just got to be a good listener. You got to be observant and you got to try to, often, people that aren't experienced have, they tend to make mistakes or go down the wrong path, at least from my point of view. Other hand, if you're too strong-armed with them to try to force them into something that they're not automatically feeling themselves, that's not a good vibration either to create. So, you know, so that's just when it's a little tricky. But, you know, when you're working with the top artists, that's when, you know, you just really, you're like a fan. You know, you're sitting there with one of these great artists and you just kind of, you know, use your skills to help them create.
Oh, yeah. Now, I got to ask you, Jeff, from me to you, man, this is one keyboardist to another, man, student to the teacher. I know this can vary from project to project, you know, but I always felt that your style as a keyboardist has always been top-notch, in my opinion. What are some of the techniques that you use to find the appropriate phrasings to fill an empty space in a song? I mean, I know sometimes we want to let the song breathe, but, you know, sometimes having those little key phrasings here and there, man, really adds the different feel and moves to the song, man. What are some of the techniques that you apply during the tracking session of finding those appropriate phrasings in a song?
There's not a real easy answer. The first thing that comes to mind when you ask me that is basically because of the experience that I've had, it's almost just intuitive. You know, you just kind of, sure, you just kind of know, how to listen and how to not overplay and but at the same time support. You know, that it's just a fine line because you have to play enough to really support and to try to, egg on the other musicians to put a lot of, you know, feeling and to keep the thing alive and to keep it pumping and keep it exciting. But at the same time, if you play too much or play too many phrases, you know, that's going to get in the way and it's going to be too cluttered and it's going to keep everybody else from having room to really be heard. So, but right, you know, basically a good rhythm section of musicians that are experienced, you just kind of fall into it. It's just a natural thing. And,
right,
you know, the obvious thing is, you know, the melody's in a certain place. If you, as a comping, like Rhodes or piano part, you know, so you play little figures that you might play, you play them in the holes, obviously, like where the melody doesn't exist.
Yeah.
I mean, that's a very obvious thing.
All right.
And I like to use my left hand too, you know, even though, sometimes I play two-handed chords behind things. Sometimes I'll play little bass figures that sort of end up, kind of like, sounding like little interesting little melodic tidbits that exist between the actual bass and the, you know, guitar and rhythm parts. So
sure,
that's kind of cool, or can even double the bass.
Oh, yeah.
Or sometimes I'll use my left hand to do the basic chords, and then I'll play just some, you know, I'll double melodic parts with my right hand, or I'll... I'll just play octaves or just some little ornamental kind of figures that, that fit into the track.
Right.
With my right hand. So, you know, you got two hands. It's
yeah.
You know, a lot of other instruments, you don't have that ability, because, like, you know, you need two hands to make a sound with a guitar or a bass or a saxophone, but with a piano, you got two hands. It's like two completely different things going on. It can be.
It is. It's two. I mean, and, you got 10 notes that you possibly play in a progression, you know. And, you know, I feel, man, I've developed into the next level of playing. I feel is when I really made my left hand more active in my playing. You know, instead of doing this the basic single note left hand, or maybe just the octaves on the left, which is cool, it's appropriate at certain times, but I really felt that I evolved as a player when I was starting the chord with my left and solo with my right. You know, and vice versa on some things, different phrasing. But, man, having that strong left to be able to chord the, you know, your foundation and progression chords and be able to solo on your right, I really feel that's where I started to see different abilities of mine start to blossom and grow. And it's still growing as we speak, man. You know, it's always a work in progress. But, you know, it's cool, man, that you mentioned you got to have both of those hands to really bring out the full potential of your playing.
Well, you know, yeah, I got to tell you this story. There's a very famous keyboard player in our business, and I'm not going to mention his name because I don't want to, you right. know, hurt anybody's feelings. But he put a record out a few years ago, and a mutual friend of mine played the record for me, and he said, "Well, what do you think of the record?" I said, "Well, I'm really worried about our friend, you know." And he said, "Why?" "Well, obviously something's happened to his left hand. He's not using his left hand. Like, did he injure it? Did he get it stuck in a car door? Or what happened to his left hand, man?"
Right.
It was just a joke because this gentleman didn't use his left hand at all on his record, basically. But, you know, in a way, that's actually a production technique that does, in a sense, that can, you know, create a cleaner, like, more sparse track.
Right.
But for me, I just, man, if I hear a keyboard player, a piano player, if I don't hear a left hand, it just makes me think, like, what happened to the poor guy?
You know, right. Well, you know, I think a lot of guys, man, I don't know, man. For me, I think it was, I started playing first. I started tracking later. But then I feel that you can get caught up in a situation where you focus primarily on tracking and producing than playing. And then your hands, you get lazy because you feel like, well, I'll just track it separately, you know.
Well, I actually, early in my career, I used to play in trios where I would play left-hand bass. And I think that was something that that helped me. And also, even when I was elementary school and junior high school and high school, I played bass in the school orchestra too.
Oh, okay.
So I've always had like a real bass-centric point of view. You know, I've always loved bass and bass lines and really focused on
right.
bass lines. And I have some students, and one of the first things I do with my students is I give them a bass line to learn with their left hand, like a blues or something or a bebop song.
Sure.
And I think that's really important for keyboard players to be able to play bass lines, and I think it's really valuable, really useful.
Oh, it is, man. I mean, for me as a funk player, I'm really heavy into my synth bass. You know, my bass lines become solos, you know, as a synth bass, just because it carries a song and you put more staccato, different dynamics on it. It just becomes an instrument, you know, so you don't have to chord your bass. You solo them. So, no, I totally agree.
Actually, that's one thing about this record that's a little different than the last record is there's actually quite a bit more synth bass on the record than the last record.
Yeah, I agree.
I think like about six of the songs have synth bass rather than electric. Although I love electric bass too.
Right.
So, you know, it's just two different ways of looking at it, but we just kind of ended up with some cool tracks with the synth bass. There's one song, Montserrat, which is one of my favorites. And I forget exactly how it happened, but there was I had another song that we were working on that was called Booty. and it was this real funky tune, and it was like, I don't know, it was like 80, 85 BPMs, 90 BPMs, somewhere in there. It was
yeah.
super, super funky. But it wasn't really making it. And then somehow, I don't know how it happened, but somehow we came up with the idea of combining Booty with Montserrat. And even though they were like radically different tempos, so we took this tune that was at 80 BPMs. So when you listen to the song and you hear all the sections that kind of sound like Tower of Power, like especially the stuff at the end,
yeah,
and you hear all these crazy, real fast bass lines.
Right.
That's because we took this other song, we sped it up from like 80 BPMs to 120 BPMs.
Wow.
And of course, when you do that, you sacrifice sound quality.
Right.
You know, we did replace quite a few things, but we kept the bass line, and luckily, that was one of the ones that that Michael Brower mixed, and he, with his magic that he had in his studio, he managed to make the bass sound real full and fat, even though the bass on those sections had been sped up from like a much slower tempo.
Sure. You know, but at the time you start layering and adding your instrument sound, it just kind of really sits well in the mix anyway. So, I mean, I don't think that was like the focal point that you're trying to make it out. It was more of an additive. So, no, it really sat well in there. I couldn't tell the difference unless you told me, to be honest with you. Amazing.
Well, that's cool. That's the way it's supposed to be.
Right.
if I sent you the Pro Tools file and you put it in solo, you probably hear a little something, though.
Oh, yeah.
That's something that we often say when we're in the studio. It's like, well, the kids at home don't have solo buttons.
That's right, man. We get a single file. We don't get the multi-track session. So
exactly. You know, but I wonder if in the future they will have solo buttons.
Oh, man. You know what? I don't doubt it, Jeff. Man, things are just evolving as we speak. It's coming pretty soon. So you're giving somebody some ideas.
Yep.
You know, we're approaching the 2012, Jeff, and we're closing out 2011. What's on the musical agenda for the closing and the beginning of the year?
Well, I mean, it's just really this Galaxy record. I'm really, you know, thrilled with how it came out. And so I'm just going to do everything I can to kind of get out there and promote it and get the word out and get people to hear it, because I think it's one of the best records I've made. Artists always say that, don't they?
No, seriously, Jeff, and I wanted to add to that, man. I really feel no matter what song you choose off that album, it's going to be able to play excellent in a live environment. You know, I'm a real big fan of, you know, having those songs translate from your CD to on stage, you know, for other band members, man. And every song on there from start to finish, I feel can really be played live on stage. You did an excellent job.
It's funny because we've already started incorporating a bunch of these tunes live. And it's quite a challenge to do it, because it's one thing to just play these songs one time in the studio and get it on, you know, the record. But to actually learn it and figure out cool arrangements and being able to solo over it takes quite a bit of work. But I'm really, really happy how that's coming along. And they're really, you know, so far we're playing Live Wire, Singaraja, and Montserrat, and Galaxy. Yeah, we're doing all four of those right now on the live show. So
all favorite ones on
the Underground we've been doing for years. So that's one of the songs that's on the record that we just wanted to sort of document the changes that have happened to that song since I originally recorded it in 1994.
Right. No, it's excellent, man. I mean, you've always had nice variations to your song, like Rain Dance and a couple other tunes you've done over the years, man. Just to watch them evolve to where your creative mind is now is just amazing, and it's truly inspirational.
Thank you very much. Well, you know, when I think back, I mean, I feel like I was really lucky, because when I first started recording, I really didn't know what I was doing. It was just youthful exuberance and enthusiasm, and you know, I've learned a lot since then.
Yeah.
And I'm just glad those early records turned out as good as they did. But now I know so much more, so it's really fun to kind of go back and revisit some of those tunes and to have the opportunity to play them with such incredible musicians like Jimmy Haslip and you know, Vinnie Caliuta, guys like
right.
that, and Paul Jackson Jr. I mean, you know, those guys add just so much to it, and so it just takes it to a whole other place.
Definitely. Well, Jeff, it's always an honor talking to you, man. I love having you on my show, man. You got so much wealth of knowledge for me, and you always send me back to the lab, try new things, man. I really appreciate it.
Well, thank you very much. It's been a pleasure talking to you.
Well, man, we'd love to have you back with your new CD or any kind of musical endeavors, man. You got a spot here at the Producer's Corner as usual.
Thank you very much.
Have a safe one, Jeff. Take it easy, man.
Okay. Thanks.
Bye. And a big shout out and thank you to Jeff Lorber for coming on the show and chopping it up with me. It's always a pleasure for me to talk to Jeff and to have him back and talk about his new CD, Galaxy. Was truly inspirational. I mean, he's got some hot material on there. As always, great musicianship and artist expression. For more information on Jeff Lorber, you need to hit up his website at www.lorber.com. www.lorber.com. And for my past and current interviews, you can hit my website up at www.spud2tight.com. www.spudtootight.com. And I'm also available on iTunes as a podcast, so if you have a Mac, a PC, an iPhone, an iPod, or an iPad, open up the iTunes store, type in the Producer's Corner of Spud Too Tight, click on my image, and you'll have a list of my past and current reviews as well. And to close out the show, I'm going to play one of my favorite tracks off of Jeff's CD, and the title of the track is called Live Wire. And again, the title of Jeff's new CD release is called Galaxy. So I want to thank everybody for tuning in and listening in. Until next time, you guys keep it tight. Peace.